We saw an old roadhouse maybe a mile later, pulled into the parking lot and got out. Looked okay. Big enough place, wide and low, built from tarred boards. Plenty of neon, plenty of cars in the lot, and I could hear music. The sign at the door said, The Pond. Live music 7 nights a week at 9:30. Roscoe and I held hands and walked in. We were hit by bar noise and jukebox music and a blast of beery air. We pushed through to the back and found a wide ring of booths around a dance floor with a stage beyond. The stage was really just a low concrete platform. It might once have been some kind of a loading bay. The ceiling was low and the light was dim. We found an empty booth and slid in. Watched the band setting up while we waited for service. The waitresses were rushing around like basketball centers. One dived over and we ordered beers, cheeseburgers, fries, onion rings. Pretty much right away she ran back with a tin tray with our stuff on it. We ate and drank and ordered more.
So, what are you going to do about Joe?
Roscoe asked me. I was going to finish his business, whatever it was, whatever it took. That was the decision I had taken in her warm bed that morning. But she was a police officer. She was sworn to uphold all kinds of laws, laws that were designed to get in my way. I didn't know what to say, but she didn't wait for me to say anything.
I think you should find out who it was killed him, she said.
And then what? I asked her. But that was as far as we got. The band started up. We couldn't talk anymore. Roscoe gave an apologetic smile and shook her head. The band was loud. She shrugged, saying sorry for the fact that I couldn't hear her talking. She sketched me a tell-you-later gesture across the table, and we turned to face the stage. I wished I could have heard her reply to my question. The bar was called The Pond, and the band was called Pond Life. They started pretty well. A classic trio, guitar, bass, drums, firmly into the Stevie Ray Vaughan thing. Since Stevie Ray died in his helicopter up near Chicago, it seemed like you could count up all the white men under 40 in the southern states, divide by three, and that was the number of Stevie Ray Vaughan tribute bands. Everybody was doing it, because it didn't require much. Didn't matter what you looked like, didn't matter what gear you had, all you needed was to get your head down and play. The best of them could match Stevie Ray's on-a-dime changes from loose bar rock to the old Texas blues. This lot was pretty good. Pond Life. They lived up to their ironic name. The bass and the drums were big, messy guys, lots of hair all over, fat and dirty. The guitar player was a small, dark guy, not unlike old Stevie Ray himself. The same gappy grin. He could play, too. He had a black Les Paul copy and a big Marshall stack. Good, old-fashioned sound. The loose, heavy strings and the big pickups overloading the ancient Marshall tubes, giving that glorious, fat, buzzy scream you couldn't get any other way. We were having a good time. We drank a lot of beer, sat tight together in the booth, then we danced for a while. Couldn't resist it. The band played on and on. The room got hot and crowded, the music got louder and faster, the waitresses sprinted back and forth with long-necked bottles. Roscoe looked great. Her silky shirt was damp. She wasn't wearing anything underneath it. I could see that because of the way the damp silk stuck to her skin. I was in heaven. I was in a plain old bar with a stunning woman and a decent band. Joe was on hold until tomorrow. Margrave was a million miles away. I had no problems. I didn't want the evening to end. The band played on until pretty late. Must have been way past midnight. We were juiced up and sloppy. Couldn't face the drive back. It was raining again, lightly. Didn't want to drive an hour and a half in the rain. Not so full of beer. Might end up in a ditch or in jail. There was a sign to a motel a mile further on. Roscoe said we should go there. She was giggly about it. Like we were eloping or something. Like I'd transported her across the state line for that exact purpose. I hadn't, specifically, but I wasn't about to put up a whole lot of objections. So we stumbled out of the bar with ringing ears and got into the Bentley. We rolled the big old car cautiously and slowly down the streaming road for a mile. Saw the motel up ahead. A long, low old place, like something out of a movie. I pulled into the lot and went into the office. Roused the night guy at the desk, gave him the money and arranged for an early morning call. Got the key and went back out to the car. I pulled it around to our cabin and we went in. It was a decent, anonymous place. Could have been anywhere in America. But it felt warm and snug with the rain pattering on the roof. And it had a big bed. I didn't want Roscoe to catch a chill. She ought to get out of that damp shirt. That's what I told her. She giggled at me, said she hadn't realized I had medical qualifications. I told her we'd been taught enough for basic emergencies.
Is this a basic emergency?
She giggled. It will be soon, I laughed, if you don't take that shirt off. So she did take it off. Then I was all over her. She was so beautiful, so provocative. She was ready for anything. Afterward, we lay in an exhausted tangle and talked about who we were, about what we'd done, about who we wanted to be and what we wanted to do. She told me about her family. It was a bad luck story, stretching back generations. They sounded like decent people, farmers, people who had nearly made it, but never did. People who had struggled through the hard times before chemicals, before machinery, hostages to the power of nature. Some old ancestor had nearly made it big, but he lost his best land when Mayor Teal's great-grandfather built the railroad. Then some mortgages were called in, and the grudge rolled on down the years so that now she loved Margrave, but hated to see Teal walking around like he owned it, which he did, and which Teal's always had. I talked to her about Joe. I told her things I'd never told anybody else, all the stuff I'd kept to myself, all about my feelings for him and why I felt driven to do something about his death, and how I was happy to do it. We went through a lot of personal stuff, talked for a long time, and fell asleep in each other's arms. Seemed like more or less straight away the guy was banging on the door with the early morning call. Tuesday. We got up and staggered around. The early sun was struggling against a damp dawn. Within 5 minutes, we were back in the Bentley rolling east. The rising sun was blinding in the dewy screen. Slowly, we woke up. We crossed the state line back into Georgia, crossed the river in Franklin, settled into a fast cruise through the empty farming country. The fields were hidden under a floating quilt of morning mist. It hung over the red earth like steam. The sun climbed up and set about burning it off. Neither of us spoke. We wanted to preserve the quiet, intimate cocoon as long as possible. Arriving back in Margrave was going to burst the bubble soon enough. So I guided the big, stately car down the country roads and hoped. Hoped there'd be plenty more nights like that one, and quiet mornings like this one. Roscoe was curled up on the big, hide chair beside me, lost in thought. She looked very content. I hoped she was. We blasted past Warburton again. The prison floated like an alien city on the carpet of low mist. We passed the little copse I'd seen from the prison bus, passed the rows of bushes invisible in the fields, reached the junction and turned south onto the county road. Past Eno's Diner and the station house and the firehouse, down onto Main Street. We turned left at the statue of the man who took good land for the railroad, down the slope to Roscoe's place. I parked at the curb and we got out, yawning and stretching. We grinned briefly at each other. We'd had fun. We walked hand in hand down the driveway. Her door was open. Not wide open, but an inch or two ajar. It was ajar because the lock was smashed. Someone had used a crowbar on it. The tangle of broken lock and splinters wouldn't allow the door to close all the way. Roscoe put her hand to her mouth and gave a silent gasp. Her eyes were wide. They slid from the door to me. I grabbed her elbow and pulled her away. We stood flat against the garage door, crouched down, stuck close to the walls and circled right around the house, listened hard at every window and risked ducking our heads up for a quick glance into every room. We arrived back at the smashed front door. We were wet from kneeling on the soaked ground and from brushing against the dripping evergreens. We stood up, looked at each other and shrugged, pushed the door open, and went inside. We checked everywhere. There was nobody in the house. No damage, no disturbance, nothing was stolen. The stereo was still there, the TV was still there. Roscoe checked her closet. The police revolver was still on her belt. She checked her drawers and her bureau. Nothing had been touched. Nothing had been searched. Nothing was missing. We stood back in the hallway and looked at each other. Then I noticed something that had been left behind. The low morning sun was coming in through the open door and playing a shallow beam over the floor. I could see a line of footprints on the parquet. A lot of footprints. Several people had tracked through from the front door into the living room. The line of prints disappeared on the bold living room rug, reappeared on the wood floor leading into the bedroom, came back out through the living room back to the front door. They had been made by people coming in from the rainy night. A slight film of muddy rainwater had dried on the wood block, leaving faint prints. Faint, but perfect. I could see at least four people in and out. I could see the tread patterns they had left behind. They had been wearing rubber overshoes, like you get for the winter up north. Chapter 16. They had come for us in the night. They had come expecting a lot of blood. They had come with all their gear, their rubber overshoes and their nylon body suits, their knives, their hammer, their bag of nails. They had come to do a job on us like they'd done on Morrison and his wife. They had pushed open the forbidden door. They had made a second fatal mistake. Now they were dead men. I was going to hunt them down and smile at them as they died, because to attack me was a second attack on Joe. He was no longer here to stand up for me. It was a second challenge, a second humiliation. This wasn't about self-defense. This was about honoring Joe's memory. Roscoe was following the trail of footprints, showing a classic reaction, denial. Four men had come to butcher her in the night. She knew that, but she was ignoring it, closing it out of her mind, dealing with it by not dealing with it. Not a bad approach, but she'd fall off the high wire before long. Until then, she was making herself busy tracing the faint footprints on her floors. They had searched the house for us. They had split up in the bedroom and looked around. Then they had regrouped in the bedroom and left. We looked for tracks outside on the road, but there was nothing. The smooth tarmac was wet and steaming. We went back inside. No evidence at all except the wrenched lock and the faint footprints throughout the house. Neither of us spoke. I was burning with anger, still watching Roscoe, waiting for the dam to break. She'd seen the Morrison corpses. I hadn't. Finley had sketched in the details for me. That was bad enough. He'd been there. He'd been shaken by the whole thing. Roscoe had been there, too. She'd seen exactly what somebody wanted to do to the two of us.
"So who were they after?"
she said at last.
"Me? You? Both of us?"
"They were after both of us," I said. "They figure Hubble talked to me in prison. They figure I've told you all about it, so they think you and I know whatever it was Hubble knew."